Yes, yes. You do your bit.
Thank you for regathering. I need to find myself a seat somewhere. I'm sat down here. Right, we move on. Don't worry, I'm not doing the second talk. It's just standing up here to introduce Svetlana Dimčević, born in Yugoslavia, but lived here pretty much all her life. Svetlana, as you can see from the title on the screen in front of you, is going to talk about Greens. Do we say drama, theatre, plays? Going to give us a bit of an overview, I think, of that, and hopefully make us laugh, I think, is what she promised. But I won't give Svetlana too much of a build-up. Svetlana's going to talk for about 30 minutes, and then we're going to open the floor to quite a few questions. So if you've got any questions, you might have some questions in mind already regarding Green and his plays, but if you think of any during the time that Svetlana's talking, then obviously have those ready as well. Svetlana Dimčević.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. It's quite difficult to follow someone like Chris, isn't it? So I'll do my best. And thank you for coming to this talk. As introduced, it's called Green in the Stalls. You'll see some scribbles through the slides. My intention is to talk from the director's point of view. I'm a director by trade. That's what I normally do. So what do directors think? How do we get things on in relation to Green? I suppose, how can we continue to get his dramas on, and what's at the heart of them? So I divide my time I between London and Nottingham at the moment. As jobbing theatre directors, I go all over. And as I was thinking about Green more intently leading up to this talk, I was reminded of a quote of his about his time in Nottingham. And he reflected that in Nottingham, it's as hard to find an intellectual as precious and rare a find, they are apparently in Nottingham, as jam in a wartime donut. So, having driven from the fine city known for Robin Hood down here this morning, I'd like to say that's not true. There are fine people in Nottingham, of course. And in fact, some of Green's productions, or productions of Green's work, have travelled to Nottingham Playhouse in the past. But I'll talk more in the round about Green in the Stalls. Green, our contemporary, can he be, as a playwright, our contemporary of directors like myself, and what's happened recently that we can reflect on. So what did directors think? Well, let's look at some of the plays. The Potting Shed, yes, tick. It's been done recently. I directed it. Recently enough in living memory that you can find something on the internet. The Living Room, same. 2 years after my production, somebody else did The Living Room. Carving a statue, big question mark. Not sure, you know, a play like that, the female character, the huge statue on the set, you know, on the stage, I don't know if people know it, but there's a godlike complex of somebody who's actually carving a statue, the father, all the way through this thing. Can we do that? Do we want to do that? The Complacent Lover, could be a Christmas show, a sort of anti-Christmas show, you know, who knows? Yes, chuckles there in the audience. For Whom the Bell Chimes, I've put Ask T, because T is our mysterious person in the theatre, on our board, or maybe in the literary department, who actually knows what that play is about. So we'll go and ask them, because we don't know For Whom the Bell Chimes. The Return of A.J. Raffles. Yeah, that's a big tick, because that was a big hit at the time. It's had impressive productions. It had a later production, you know, maybe in our lifetimes, sort of thing. So yeah, maybe that's a tick as well. And then there's Yes and No, and I've put maybe. Yes and No is a short play where one of the actors only says yes and no, almost like a drama school exercise. You know, one of them has got a great part with lots of lines, and another one has just yes and no. So maybe that's a lunchtime. Not sure. So this is how we think, you know, this is what we would do when we're thinking about a season or we're thinking about pitching to a theatre. I'm going to a meeting, there's no subject to the meeting, they're just going to say, what do you want to do? So let's say I have Green in my mind and I want to do another. What am I going to do with these plays? There are some radio plays, there are snippets and so on. Let's concentrate on these. Let's say these are plays we could pitch. How am I going to do? So if we go to the ones that are most produced historically, maybe this will give me some meat. Maybe the artistic directors of today are so worried about people not going to the theatre post-COVID. They might say, well, what are we going to put in the brochure? You know, It's by Graham Greene. Do we have anything else? Anybody famous been in it? Or when was it last done, or was it successful? So The Return of A.J. Raffles. Yes, London, 1975, the Royal Shakespeare Company production. Okay, that's good. That's got some meat to it. Canada, 1979. Oxford Playhouse, 1979. Watford Palace, 1994. I tried to find some information about this. Deborah Shaw, a very fine director, directed it, and I couldn't find a great deal, because of course the internet has changed the world, and 94 was just before. So yes, you can go to theatre archives and so on, but your theatre management might say, okay, well what's A.J. Raffles about then? Let's talk about it. Should we talk about the subject? How do we fit it into a season? It is a little of its time. It's an Edwardian play about a heist. It's really somebody seeking revenge by stealing something from a big house. You know, and it's expensive, it's got lots of parts. Not sure, but of its time, very much successful, as I've just put there. Let's move to The Living Room. Okay, this one, Edinburgh and West End, 1953 to 1954. The Living Room is a curious play, but it's arguably perhaps Greene's most famous in that it had a total of 308 consecutive performances in the West End in its first production. We have got to marvel at that. Of course, now we have musicals that are on for 15 years, but 308 consecutive performances is a real, real hit. So it went to Broadway too. Maybe the American audiences didn't like it as much. Maybe they didn't understand it as much, but it doesn't matter. Substantial history there. And then nothing happens until 2013 of any note. Now in 2013, a fellow director, more of that later, picks it up and does it in a very small theatre. Compared to the West End, of course, it's a totally different experience for the audience. And the third contender here, The Potting Shed. Well, I directed this in 2010 and 2011. 2011 was the notable production. It ran for a month, again, in a small theatre in London. Again, totally different to how it would have originally perhaps been done. But it's a play from 1957/1958. And in fact, I believe, from some of the stuff that you can read on it, is that there was some tweaking of the ending also. So a play that I will reflect on as one of the greatest productions that I've ever worked on. It's brilliant, but has not been one of the better known works by Graham Greene. So how do we proceed? What do we do next? If we look at The Return of A.J. Raffles, we're starting to see some patterns here. There are sort of tribes of Greene folk, aren't there? I mean, I'm speaking to one, presumably, this morning. So there's Greene, and there's the old Aldwych Theatre, a beautiful theatre on the Strand, large stage, lots of seats, big thing, West End. Well, it premiered there in 1975, the year that I was born. And it was, you know, A.J. Raffles, the lead, was played by Denham Mitchell Elliott, there on the left, a face you will all recognise from many things you've seen, either replayed on telly, films, theatre, maybe some of you knew the gentleman personally, who knows. And of course, on the right-hand side, Bunny, played by Clive Francis. At the time, Clive Francis was a younger actor than in the picture. However, it's really key to put that big circle around Clive Francis and say he loves Greene. Because he does love Greene, he's got a distinguished approach and history of doing Greene, and it's those sorts of folks who might lead to the future of where Greene goes in the stalls. Because without the friends and the pals gathering around a subject, we're not going to get it on. So there's Francis, Clive Francis, loves Greene. We've circled his head. Now, let's move on. So whilst A.J. Raffles is a snapshot of the times, I'm not sure how much a modern TikTok watching, Snapchat, Facebook, Netflix audience are into A.J. Raffles doing a heist because somebody offended his friend Oscar Wilde. The Living Room is a bit different. It's very claustrophobic. In a way, you could almost argue that it's because of the setting, one-room setting. You could do a studio, you could even do a television series, perhaps. It is a bit more modern. So in the living room, this is the 2013 production. We've got various actors there in the pictures, Christopher Timothy and Tuppence Middleton. Tuppence Middleton made her debut as Rose and was fantastic. The critics picked up on the fact that all the actors' performances were really superb. This is a play about repressed desire, about an extramarital affair between a young woman and a much older man. It is at its heart also about evil as a big subject, in that the reason why this play is called The Living Room, and nobody discusses this outright in the first part of the play, they have sectioned off a huge house to live in one room. the brother, the priest in the wheelchair, and his sisters, all of an age, because other rooms in the house have experienced death and they are afraid of using the other rooms in the house. So it's sort of Green taking a huge country house like A.J. Raffles and then reducing it to one room. And here we have pictures from the German Street Theatre, which is a studio theatre in the West End, but not quite of the West End. And this is from a production by a director called Tom Littler. So Tom, there he is. He loves Green too. He's a smiling chap and he loves Green, another one of us. Tom spoke to me about the play. I said to him, look, Tom, I'm speaking to Graham Greene fans and people who are very knowledgeable about Greene, and you're a director and you're intelligent. Can you tell me why you did this play 2 years after I did The Potting Shed? You know, quite independently. We didn't know each other then. And he said that he was drawn to the play because of the way that those characters are kind of stuck. So he's given us a quote there, and he's happy for me to say this out loud. Most directors don't necessarily want to talk about their process. It remains private. Tom says, an incredibly claustrophobic atmosphere. It's an airless play, an airless house. I wanted the play to grip the audience in a vice and use the small theatre to that end. It was really one of the most satisfying productions I've done in using a modern acting sensibility to animate an older play. I'd love to do it again and more Green. I echoed the last sentiment, definitely, I'd love to do it again and more Green. But what's really interesting here, from one director to another, is that this play was originally a West End production on a big stage, and what he's done there is he's totally turned it upside down. He's used a really tiny space to make it feel even more claustrophobic. And the idea that he talks about using a modern acting sensibility, this struck a chord with me, because we can do period pieces in period acting style. Our actors are, on the whole, in Britain, trained to do anything that is necessary. So in a Shakespearean production, they are being Shakespearean. I mean, you know, and in an Edwardian comedy, they are doing all the right things not to be too modern about it. But the question is, at the heart of that, talking about the acting sensibility, I suppose, is Green, the dramatist, our contemporary, or does he belong in that period category? Must we stage him as a period playwright? Should we try to stage him as if he is there in the stalls with us watching the rehearsals? And that is the crux of the matter, because that is where, to my mind, we come into a schism with some of our critics. I believe that they come to the productions, they want to see Green the dramatist, but at the same time, they invariably comment on some of the dated nature of the plays. And this is only the plays they've seen produced. They've not seen Carving a Statue, for instance. Don't know what they'd make of that. And so how can we modernize, I suppose, and maybe reach a, may I say this without being heckled, slightly younger audience in years to come? We rely in the theatre on very intelligent people who can come to the theatre and who love coming to the theatre, like yourselves. What happens in 50 years' time? I wonder, will the new generation want to come to a production of a Green play? In fact, Will they be going to the theatre at all? One does have that dark thought in the middle of the night sometimes. So Tom there was trying to direct it with this modern sensibility. He talked to me about the actors doing lots of back to the audience acting, etc. Can't have been easy for Christopher Timothy, who's in a wheelchair for the show, to do back to the audience as well on top of that. Because, of course, we have a priest who is disabled. In a tale of extramarital affairs and crisis of identity. So the living room, it had a good response in 2013. It's not been done since, and that was a big gap before its original productions and when it was actually done. And Tom Littler now is taking over the Orange Tree. So if you love green, go and knock on the door, see what happens. You know, if you've got an adaptation like Life of Francis in the back of your desk, go and ask. Moving on then to the potting shed. I mean, Tom and I joke, and you know, maybe he can blame me because I did the potting shed first and then he did the living room. You know, that there was something that we picked up on that other people hadn't staged. So the potting shed, I've put there, lapsed Catholics in redemption. But really, it's a play about finding the reason why so many years later there might be a neurosis. The actor there on the right, Paul Cawley, as James Callifer, the man who can't move on psychologically because something happened to him as a boy in the potting shed. So what we have here is a real case of a play which attracted me so much because of the depth of characterization. That moral dilemma that not just James Callifer, but the other characters also have and need to go through. At the heart of this play, which is, by the way, a three-act play with two intervals, how very, very period. And they said in the production rehearsals and so on, the actors, the set designer, everybody said, are you keeping two intervals? And I said, well, yes. I shall have it as was, and let's see why the intervals are there. There must be a reason. There is, of course, a rhythmical reason why Green gives the audience an opportunity to have a glass of wine. And anecdotally, I may tell you, I can't reveal the name, of course, somebody came out from my industry, out of the first interval, broody, out of the second interval in tears. And I said, are you all right? I need a glass of wine. So maybe Green was onto something, giving us those two intervals. But the thing about the potting shed is the priest who has given his faith up to save his nephew. So it's a deal that's struck at the heart of the play. And that's what happened in that potting shed all those years ago. And that is what this play is about. It's about James Callifer, the protagonist, going backwards in time to discover what stopped him moving on. And at the beginning of the play, his father is dying upstairs. He's arrived back at the family house. He has not gained an audience. He doesn't get in. He doesn't see his father for that final closure. And so the play unravels. Well, Kenneth Tynan, famous critic of the time, who had quite an acerbic wit, I would suggest, from his writings, wrote, not a whodunit, but a god done it. And in some respects, he's right. Because, of course, it's about it is about the idea of the presence and absence of God, the presence and absence of faith. Are miracles really possible? Can faith be used as a casino trick? Can you trade it in for something else? I suppose a theme that Green and his fans and his readership are familiar with from the novels and from his own journey through that question. We'll leave it there, I think. Michael Billington of The Guardian, and this is terribly important for us, not only does it influence some of our audience, but it definitely influences some of our artistic directors, in turn influencing what gets put on. So it's a cycle for us. Michael Billington said, a sense of mounting pressure. Paul Cawley's James is a model of middle-aged anguish. Very kind of him to say that. Paul Cawley was fantastic in the role. And the Financial Times perhaps liked the play more than some of the other critics, which was curious. Actually, they don't often review plays. They said the conflict between atheism and religious faith is at the heart of the matter. Financial Times. Well, they're playing on their on the heart of the matter there. But I loved doing this play. There is something in the middle of it about this idea of the presence and absence of faith or God, and you know, in response to Kenneth Tynan, one isn't of a generation to have been able to engage in a real conversation with him. I would have enjoyed that. James Callifer says, when he goes to see his uncle, the whiskey priest who gave the faith up to save him, I don't need any other proof of God than the lack of him there. I've seen the mark of his footsteps going away. This is very interesting. We had an actor called Martin Wimbush there, first picture, black and white, as the priest. And he came to the first rehearsal, he came to the second rehearsal, he came to the third rehearsal. He looked a little bit like Grieg, you know, he was in a beige suit, slightly crumpled, and very much looking into the distance, observing, thinking about it. Because, of course, he didn't come on until much later. He wasn't really on until the second act. He was listening and listening and listening and listening, and he said, "Gosh, I love this play. It's so layered, it's so true. I've got to find the truth in that bargain. I've got to find the truth. I wanted to save this boy." So we did a lot of drama exercises. This is the stuff that never makes it on stage, with the older actor playing himself at 13 and Martin playing the priest, finding him, the priest who still believes, finding him in that potting shed. We played that moment as a memory for them in rehearsals. We couldn't think of a much better thing for the poster, so we just found a lane in a country village and thought, well, that could lead to a potting shed, I suppose. I guess. The Financial Times, in their review, asked, "What do you keep in your potting shed? Shears? Gardening gloves? A few terrible memories? What is it?" You know, and so this idea that the potting shed is such a prosaic little thing that exists. It's another word for a garden shed. They're interchangeable. Do even modern audiences know the difference? Why is it called a potting shed? Do they understand what this means? You know, stop a 14-year-old in the street. Do they think you keep pots in there? I mean, I don't know, you know. So it's a play of its time, but at the end of the day, it's a prosaic shed where this life-changing event took place. And we have some pictures there of the actors, again, done in a small studio theatre, the Fimbra Theatre, very well known for revivals and things that haven't been done for a long time. A small theatre attended by critics, religiously. They do go. Perhaps I've used the word religiously a little bit loosely there, I do apologise. And really, that is where this play found its place in 2011. In 2010, we did a Sunday-Monday production as a test. And what we found was that audiences were turning up saying they'd heard about it on the internet, some of them looking like they don't really use the internet. So one wondered about the power of the word of mouth, the power of people to speak to each other and say, "Hey, this thing is on, and it hasn't been on since 1958. Maybe you want to catch it." And then we went to the Arts Council and we said, "This play has a big cast. Could we please have a grant to put it on properly so it's not just Sundays and Mondays?" And they gave us a grant. So we did it for a full run, and that is why Michael Billington could talk about the, you know, the anguish in the play, and that is why these critics were able to respond to it. A lot of them calling it obscure because it hadn't been staged for so long. Another curious fact is that Cliff Richard played James Callifer for 5 nights in 1970-something in a small production which nobody knows about, but one wonders what that must have been like. There are only some historical photos of the programme. There isn't really much that survives of that, but I thought I would share it with you in case you didn't know. So once we've seen what plays are done, with whatever frequency, we then go, "Oh, but hang on a moment, I read about another production of something by Green." Of course, the novel adaptations. There have been a few, and they've done the tour of the UK, they've done various theatres, they've come to various audiences. And a novel adaptation is quite a specific beast, but if done well, it can be brilliant. You are banking on the fact that people have read and know the novel, or at least maybe seen the film of the novel, and the person they're going with has read the novel, so it's a nice sort of mix. And some of the novels are obviously fun. Well, we've just heard a talk about A Man in Havana, but this is the theatre adaptation. And it was adapted by none other than Clive Francis extremely well. It was very successful. It kept touring and touring and touring. People loved it. And The Guardian, again, can't stress enough how important this is in the whole programming thing, said that Francis's adaptation fillets the novel into a fast-moving, four-handed farce. So somebody might have put that a little bit differently and said, you know, he's chopped whole chunks out of it and it doesn't work. But no, actually it did work. What skill to have pulled it off, and what skill that there weren't swathes of newspaper articles about how it's butchered Green's work and it's no good, because it's got to fit into a maximum of about 2 hours playtime. You're going to have to lose some detail. And I was very interested to hear the talk about the filming of Our Man in Havana. So much depends on the collaborators. So much depends on the chemistry in the room or on set. So many things can go wrong because it's human beings working with each other. However much the material is set, the script is brilliant, the location is stunning, things can go wrong along the way. That chemistry can get disrupted. So with Our Man in Havana for the theatre, the chemistry was perfect. It worked and worked and worked. There were also a couple of the others that are notable. Brighton Rock, with Sarah Middleton there and Jacob James Beswick, was actually adapted by Brownie Lavery, who is a very well-known theatre playwright. And she changed it, rather. She sort of, there are interviews with her which are curious. She said, oh, but I was interested in changing it, so I changed it. She rather took her own view. I suppose playwrights are commissioned to have their own view. And this was an adaptation of a well-known piece. So you could argue that's okay. People know what the original is. There have been films as well, of Brighton Rock. But it was interesting to see that that production was also well received on the whole by critics, and that yet the playwright wanted to change it, to alter it slightly. The recent film, recent enough, with Helen Mirren in it, I don't know if people have seen it, I presume yes, also changed it rather. It changed the time. It put it into a different decade. So that is an intervention. And there is an argument to be made for Green the contemporary in the stalls, that we do these things to the plays, that we go, right, well, let's put The Potting Shed in 2003, see what happens. You can. With a novel adaptation, it's a little bit easier to get away with it because you are not going against the playwright's wishes. We have a history of directors in the UK working with writers in the room. The playwright is there. We don't want to go against their wishes. It is not our intention. Our intention is, if we love the play, to bring it to life as the author intended. It's a bit problematic if your author is dead, because you can't ask questions. You've just got the stage directions and perhaps some thoughts that they wrote down about how they felt about the play, and maybe they were then superseded by other thoughts that weren't noted. So it is a bit tricky. One always has the urge to find the telephone that would get you the link, to be able to ask that crucial question that you think can really inform the production. You're not always able to do that, as I say, if the playwright isn't there, or if the writer, in the case of Green, we must call him a writer. He's not a playwright, or just a playwright. He's a writer, a much more holistic, rounded figure. The ability to phone him up or to ask a question is just being removed. I directed a Harold Pinter play a long time ago, and I was able to speak to Harold Pinter on the phone, and it made all the difference, because he basically didn't give anything away that we didn't discover in rehearsal, but it was supportive to be able to ask and be told, well, it's for you to discover. Then you know you're all right, you can go and do it. You haven't gone against their wishes. So with Brighton Rock, presumably Bryony Lavery and Graham Greene would have had an interesting coffee. But it was a successful production, and the theatre, you know, commissioning it felt that this was the way to go for their audience, then perhaps today's audience. And then there's Travels with My Aunt, revival there with Geoffrey Holland and Clive Francis again. There's Clive Francis again, a lover of green. That was equally successful. People loved it. Travels with My Aunt is just such fun, you know. So it makes sense as an upbeat show. And perhaps we have to, with novel adaptations, be careful that they're not long and dreary and too detailed. And Travels with My Aunt could never be that. But this production was really, really good. And there have been others, and I'm sure I'd like to have a discussion with all of you, because you probably know much more collectively about green than I ever could. And so we talk about green in the stalls. We sit shoulder to shoulder as directors in today's theatre with our playwright on the one side, but on opening night on the other side are all the critics. And we have to wait for them to give their review. We have to work with the review. Sometimes they're great, sometimes they're just in the middle, sometimes they're not very good at all. And we have to understand the cycle of how the review affects the producers and the artistic directors putting the plays on. We also have to understand the cycle of how the review affects the audience, because it does. We've seen in the theatre, and this is now backstage information, please don't go forward and tell everybody else, because then there'll be nobody coming. Post-COVID, we've seen a real fluctuation. We can't even always explain the fluctuation in the audience numbers. It doesn't seem to follow previous patterns. Audiences are not returning in the same numbers as they came before COVID. So, this is true of a studio theatre and of the West End. So, we are in a situation where we have got, on the one hand, the critics, on the other hand, an audience who aren't rushing to the theatre in the same way that they did before. A talk for another day as to why. And we have this strange thing in the middle, which is that the critics have an opinion and a view of something they're watching. We who have made it may have a totally contrary opinion and view, and we're all trying to do it for the audience. And the audience sometimes have a filter. They read the review and maybe they decide not to watch something. Or maybe they don't care. But anyway, here's the position. With all these productions and the plays that we've talked about today, most notably The Potting Shed, The Living Room, and these adaptations of the novels, A Man in Havana, perhaps the most known, but Travels with My Aunt as well, Brighton Rock and so on. With our friends at The Guardian, they're all coming in at 3 stars. So actually, there's a pattern. Weirdly enough, I'm not into statistics, but as I piece them together, we're always at the 3-star mark, no matter what. Doesn't matter who's done it, doesn't matter how it's been done. All of these productions were really great, you must believe me. Mine was one of them, I wouldn't say anything different. Why is it coming in at 3 stars? What is that? Why is it not 4 or 5? Why is it not 1 or 2? You know, the 1-star review, this is so terrible. You must almost see it because it's so terrible. And why isn't it saying, well, Green are contemporary, this is incredible. These plays, why have they sat in editions that people haven't done? Are these directors and producers so scared of doing something nobody else has done? Why is it? No, we are consistently hitting at the 3-star review. Yes, some will give us a 4 and a 5, perhaps, but not really for these revivals. The 4-star review in the Financial Times for The Potting Shed, I just considered to be an odd one out, really. They liked it. Maybe they have a potting shed. Who knows? So why? Why are we in a position where it's as if the critics can't make up their mind? The 3-star review is a little bit like sitting on the fence. Can I tell you tomorrow? You know, it's not quite the full praise, but it's not quite the full damnation either. You're in the middle. It's a solid review. They reflect on the performances, they reflect on the interesting subjects at play. They do say, perhaps, these are of their time. These are overshadowed by something that was fashionable at the time, the well-made West End play, or whatever it is. But I'm not sure that's the be-all and end-all. I think that there's something else. And I'm trying to be young at heart. I'm trying to direct down the ageway as well as up the ageway, because I'm aware that as I age as a director, my audience may not age at the same sort of rate as me. And eventually, I need to be able to reach the slightly younger crowd too. If they see the word dated, I'm not sure they're coming. So I was curious to delve into this idea of green art contemporary through some of the reviews, but through some discussions with people I know too. And really, the subjects are so interesting, the characterizations so potent. I sort of want to ask you, where do we go next? My only offer to that is something unexpected. Something the audience didn't think, or the critics, that they were going to get. A sort of ace in your card pack. Question mark. I'd like to hear questions from the audience, please.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it. I just wanted to mention that in Milwaukee, where I come from, there was a production mounted of the living room by a professional but community kind of group at a Catholic university for a couple of weekends, and it was mobbed.
Mm-hmm.
The students and more very much enjoyed it.
Thank you very much for that. I found quite the same. We couldn't turn people away from the potting shed. We had nowhere to go. I couldn't watch it for most of the performances because it was sold out completely. So the audience are there.
Well, thank you. I'm from Germany. I did the translation of Clive Francis's adaptation of Our Man in Havana and also wrote an adaptation of Dr. Fischer in English, indeed. And I offered it to several theaters in Berlin and Germany, all over Germany, and had long talks with theater directors about it, and everybody loved it, although Our Man in Havana, as well as Dr. Fischer, are really based in their times. So contemporary makes it difficult, but everybody thought and agreed that the characters are described so precisely and so interestingly that it doesn't matter whether you take it in the specific time it belongs to. It would be interesting, nevertheless. The only problem they had was that the cast would have been so vast and so big,
yes,
and it was in COVID times, so it was impossible to stage it. They would have needed two persons on stage, and even though it would be too expensive as well, because as here as well, the German audience didn't come anymore, and now they are not coming either. So yeah, that was a problem, but I think it's well worth doing it, and I think it's not necessary to put it in nowadays times or have a very modern approach to it. I think it stays topical, yeah.
That's brilliant, thank you. I think it's really interesting to hear the reach of green in other countries as well, because obviously we're talking about the novels being read in translation. We're talking about work that is travelling across borders. We know we're talking about an international writer of international renown, but it's really interesting to hear that from Germany. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. About 10 years ago, we went to a production of Travels with My Aunt in the States. It was an all-male cast, three very, very good actors. It was a community college in the state of Maryland, and it was very, very well done and very well received by the audience.
In fact, I think they played in excess of 30 odd parts. And when you read the reviews, and it's one of the productions originating in Scotland, they played so many different roles. It becomes this masterclass of acting when it's a novel adaptation with just four actors. And extraordinary for the audience. If they're in, they're fully in. Thank you.
I went to see this production in April in a place called Bad Vimpfen. Bad Vimpfen's got a population of about 7,500 people. And I was actually quite amazed that this theatre group actually put on Unsere Männer und Weiber. And it was put on in it was a wonderful production. I think there's about six actors playing about 15 to 16 parts. The audience was extremely limited. I couldn't wait to see the play, but not many people went to the play. And what I found, it was a generation thing. The people who were there, maybe of an older category, was there, but the younger generation probably don't even know what Unsere Männer und Weiber is, what it may be even about. And what I did find is it was very poorly publicised. I felt that it could have been much stronger publicised within the town, but what also surprised me, that the town was only 7,500, yet they were prepared to put on this production. And this was put on in other small towns in Baden-Württemberg. I don't know whether they ever went into other states, into Germany. And the thing when I came away with the impression, I think it's marvellous that a small theatre group are prepared to put on such a play, but I think from my other point of view, I was disappointed that it didn't really reach a wider audience. We reached a very limited audience. And I don't know whether that is because it's because Graham Greene is not known, let's say, so well in Germany, or the younger generation have not got a wish to go to a theatre so with different media outlets. The younger generation are going less and less to the theatre. So I think
yes,
it would be very
I want you to have a stab at answering that first, please.
I best may answer to that because I know.
Yes.
Indeed, it's a question of theatre culture in Germany, which is not as popular with every generation as it is in England. I mean, when you go to the West End, you still have queues. You would never see that in Germany, not even in Berlin, which is has I don't know how many theaters we're having in Berlin, but many, and they're famous. But it's a different culture, and theater in Germany is rather known to be for the conservative older generation, or it's so extremely difficult to understand if it wants to be modern that younger generations would go there, not understand anything, and think it's great. So. Yeah, I mean, it's directors who masturbate basically on ideas. Sorry to say so, but that's what's happening. So a story like Our Man in Havana, as you said, maybe nobody ever heard about it. Green is not known at all in Germany. That was one of the reasons why I wanted to do these adaptations, because I think it's a shame that nobody knows this author. Really, it is. And certainly not the younger generations. They may have heard of Shakespeare and Hemingway, if even, but certainly not of Greene. So yeah, that might be a reason that they didn't go. And I saw that performance too, and went to the premiere, and it was so sad. There was basically nobody. It was a dark little theater, and I mean, due to COVID, there were not many people allowed in the audience, but still. No premiere party, no press, nothing, basically. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's a typical German issue.
I'd also like to introduce the elephant in the room called social media. So, of course, some younger audiences are only driven by social media feeds, which is fine. And when you look for a social media feed on Green, it's not as present. Let's just leave it at that. It's very difficult to find an Instagram feed or a, right? Because it just isn't something that has grown in that way. Usually the social media feeds are around the release of a new film or around a new theatre production, and back in 2011 and 2013 it was in its infancy compared to where we are today. And today we're just overwhelmed by it. So I am keen to see whether in my directing lifetime more greening can be done by more people who understand it and love it, but that more others who don't know much about it can discover it. And what is that magic key, almost like a Harry Potter thing, you know, how do you get something into the lock and unlock it? Once you've unlocked it, that's it. And the associated things that go with productions and films that drive that new audience, something coming back or being rediscovered or in fact being discovered for the first time. So, yeah.
Can I play devil's advocate on this question of why there have been so few revivals of Greene's plays? And although I'm a great fan of his and find them very interesting, the plays, the trio of plays in the 1950s, where I think Greene is working through his relationship with Catholicism, can I say that I think he is what I would describe as a proscenium arch playwright, in that he is, obviously he was from his age, he saw things in terms of the proscenium arch. He was writing his plays at a time when there was that revolution with things like Look Back in Anger, which was moving it on, but he was stuck in the old tradition. I think that's possibly one reason. And the other reason, which I'd be very interested to hear what you think, but the words in the play, they're very wordy, which sounds an odd thing for a play to talk about, but they're very wordy, and the language is stilted in comparison with his novels, where the dialogue comes across so spontaneous and so on, and so believable. And so there is that difference, and I wonder whether that, what your reaction as having produced his plays, whether there were problems for the actors with the dialogue particularly, and also a comment on the fact that you're stuck with this proscenium arch type tradition from which he seemed to be working in.
Yeah, thank you. So with the proscenium arch thing, yeah. Yes, it is a form of its time, but you can turn it around. You can take the living room and put it in the round. You can have a traverse staging, you can have a revolving set, you could, unless the estate told you not to, you could stage it in a number of ways. I mean, this is what we do every day in the theatre. We think, oh, should we, hang on a minute, what if the audience is sitting all the way around? That's what happened with Cats. They didn't think initially, oh, let's put the audience on the stage and have everybody look like a cat. That came a bit later. The first thing was, oh, it's a West End musical, they've got to sing out. And then they decided, no, they don't have to sing out. We can make it more, you know, breaking those barriers. So in that sense, it is in the eye of the beholder whether you're going to do proscenium arch or not. It is maybe written with that intent, but, well, so was Shakespeare written with the intent that it would be done very differently to today? No actresses, for a start. But still, we do it in many different ways. So that's one, and that's for the imagination of the people approaching the play to try and get a production that's fresh and feels right for them. The second question about the stilted dialogue. You know, actors are fantastic creatures. They come at something, and it sounds a bit odd for a couple of weeks, and then suddenly, it's real. So in the potting shed in rehearsals, I remember that the actors were getting used to the lines, talking about the subject, what are we doing here, what's the subtext, and so on. And then one day it just dropped, and it was just there. It felt like totally everyday speech. Speech you would hear, you know, over here on the train today. So that's about skill, and unless we've got the skill and we persevere, we've either got the wrong cast or we wouldn't be able to do anything that came before now, because we would have the same problem with Edwardian work, with anything, really. So in that sense, I think perhaps that's more the interpretation of what's been put in front of the audience and or how the thing reads on the page. I've read a lot of scripts, and a lot of scripts on the page are not convincing. You do have to work to hear it, to see it, to imagine it. It's dry on the page. However brilliant it is, it can be very dry. So that's my personal view. But I'm a lover of green. I'm already sitting in the camp, so it's difficult.
I just wanted to ask you, I remember seeing a version, I think it was The Living Room. It would be about 1970s there, put on by Brian Forbes.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember anything very much about it, but I wondered if you'd come across it in your...
Yes, that's well documented. That would have been one of the...
It comes in the gap.
One can go to the theatre museum archives and so forth and go through all these things, but now we're so used to getting a footage of something, you know, watching it. I've not been able to find that.
Yeah, it was a theatre production.
Yes, but it hadn't... What I mean is now, a theatre production is only as good as stills photos. It's difficult to understand how it was. I wish I was there, as I said, probably still in nappies. Depends which end of 1975, maybe not even yet out.
Well, there's other famous people who were born in 1975, of course. A certain Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng were both born in that year, so congratulations.
I'm going to do this now.
Obviously a great year. I just wonder if, as someone seeking to put green on in theatrical productions, you're finding... flanking movement.
Well, you see, we've got to get on with the job at hand, so we could never do any directing if we were thinking along those lines. Unfortunately, it would be impossible to get up in the morning and have an opinion. You would be thinking, oh no, but the Guardian's going to hate this, but this other person is going to buy a ticket. What do I do? So you've got to go with your gut feeling. I'm a believer in going with directing stuff you really are passionate about. I don't want to direct a thing that's just a job. I don't want to do it. So I go for it and I think, well, we might get this, we might get that. But then I just push the thought out of my head. If it's already been approved and we're going for it and we're putting a poster up and we're selling tickets, if we're not convinced, who will be? So I just go for it. But yes, you sometimes think, might be a hard sell. Hate those words. Or, you know, you think, we could get heckled. Somebody might hate it so much. There's going to be, you know, all sorts of, a Twitter storm about this. But you've got to go for it.
As a young person who's really into Graham Greene, I thought it might be useful just to reflect on, you know, from talking to friends or whatever, where is he connecting versus where perhaps not? And I think that then talks to what you were saying around how do you relevance, etc. So I would say I think the novels are very strong. I think actually, if I think about my friends, how they get to Green is they maybe find Le Carré a bit too pretentious and they find Fleming a bit too racy. So then they read Our Man in Havana and they love the character development. They love From the Quiet American that it captures that particular moment in Vietnam. I think though, when I think about the plays, maybe the slightly ignorant fear is it going to be kinetic enough? Or is it going to be 3 hours of Catholic angst, which I think you guys are massive Green enthusiasts. So I do not want to offend anyone in this room at all. But I think sometimes, you know, you can roll your eyes and be like, just treat people well, Graham. Okay. It's, you don't need to say all these Hail Marys just to absolve yourself. Just try and be a better person sometimes, maybe. So I guess what I'm saying is there's that fear that maybe when you get into these more introspective elements of his work, which the plays might be, they might not, is it going to be kinetic? Is it going to be something that kind of shows movement and relevance today? Would be, I think, what a younger person would ask. And that's why I want to read the plays. I want to actually experience them. But the novels are alive and well, is what I would just reflect amongst my friends.
Thank you very much. That's really interesting because not only have we got a younger Green fan in the room, but also you're very frank. And I think audiences, younger audiences today, there's less politeness. I love that. On social media, people will go for you. You know, they will say, whatever they want to say. It's there. It's there in a flash. You can't change it. You can't retrieve it. You can't delete it. It's there. It's out in the ether. The democracy of social media overpowers any other kind of democracy out there at all available, because it's global and it's immediate and it's not censored and you can't change it. So I like that. I would love to have more people like you coming to the productions, if we can get some more productions on, and having a debate about it and telling us, you know, you're barking up the wrong tree, stage something more modern. Or, hang on a minute, that was actually quite interesting. And is it about the way the productions are done? Is it, again, the angst of a three-hour production that's about something very heavy and not particularly linked to you also affects theatre directors going to other people's work? So you do sometimes think, right, it's going to be a long evening. And we don't want the audience to come to the theatre with that thought before it started. So thank you very much.
So I was just wondering, is there something wrong, actually, with the critics? I mean, I was just very interested that, for me, the Financial Times is a really, really good critic of all sorts of things. And that was the paper that really liked it. And I do wonder whether some of the other critics are really rather aged and very stuck and rather old-fashioned, and particularly my own generation, put off younger people because they're really hung up on this wretched Catholic business, which I think is really, quite frankly, often irrelevant.
I couldn't possibly comment on the critics. But thank you for your point. Oh, we have a question at the back as well. Gentleman at the back.
Very interesting. I was just wanted to share with you a snippet from my memories. My grandmother, Vivian Green, asked me to accompany her to see A.J. Raffles, and I was 19 at the time. And I absolutely love it. And but it's true, I haven't seen anything about it since. And I enjoyed the play as a young teenager. So,
thank you. One for the memoirs, I think, when you come round.
Can I ask, Svetlana, have you any plans to do a green play in the near future?
I would love to do a green play in the near future. I haven't any concrete plans. I would like to do something that could perhaps surprise and grab the audience and the critics. I have to leave it there. Thank you.